Well, today we come to the 12th President of the United States, Zachary Taylor. And he served from March 4th, 1849 to July 9th, 1850. And as usual, we're starting out with some fun facts concerning this president. He was a descendant of William Brewster. His family could trace their roots directly to the English official and Mayflower passenger William Brewster. And Brewster was a key separatist leader and preacher in the Plymouth colony. And Taylor's father had also served in the American Revolution. He was a career military officer. He never attended college, having been taught by a number of tutors. He joined the military and served from 1808 to 1848 when he became president. He did participate in the War of 1812. He was part of the defense of Fort Harrison in Indiana during the War of 1812. And during that war, he attained the rank of major. And after the war, he was soon promoted up to the rank of colonel. And in the summer of 1832, Taylor saw action in the Black Hawk War. Chief Black Hawk led his force of Sauk and their allies, the Fox Indigenous Tribe in Illinois and Wisconsin territories, against the United States Army. And between 1835 and 1842, Taylor fought in the Second Seminole War in Florida. And in that conflict, Chief Osceola led the Seminole Indians in an effort to avoid migrating west of the Mississippi River. While that had been agreed to in the Treaty of Payne's Landing, the Seminoles had not been principal parties in those deliberations. And it was during this war that Taylor was given his nickname Old Rough and Ready by his men. He also became a war hero during the Mexican War. And this started as a border dispute between Mexico and Texas. General Taylor was sent by President James Knox Polk in 1846 to protect the border at the Rio Grande. However, Mexican troops attacked and Taylor defeated them despite having fewer men. That action led to a declaration of war. And despite successfully attacking the city of Monterey, Taylor gave the Mexicans a two-month armistice, which upset President Polk. Taylor led U.S. forces at the Battle of Buena Vista, defeating Mexican General Santa Anna's 15,000 troops with 4,600 of them. Taylor used that success at this battle as part of his campaign for the presidency in 1848. At that point, the Whig Party nominated Taylor to be president without his knowledge or presence at the nominating convention. They sent him notification of the nomination without postage paid, but he refused to pay the postage and did not find out that the nomination had happened for weeks. The main political issue during that 1848 election was whether the new territories gained in the Mexican War would be free or slave states. And although Taylor held enslaved people himself, he did not state a position during that election. Because of this stance and the fact that he had been an enslaver himself, he garnered the pro-enslavement vote, while the anti-enslavement vote was divided between candidates for the Free Soil Party and the Democratic Party. The Clayton-Bulwer Treaty was an agreement between the United States and Great Britain. It was signed in 1850 that related to the status of canals and colonization in Central America that passed while Taylor was president. And both sides agreed that all canals would be neutral and neither side would colonize Central America. Well, Taylor died on July 8, 1850. And we'll find out in a little bit what led to that. But as we do a study of this man, he didn't last very long in the presidency. We find out a little bit about his roots. First of all, and we get this from the book The Presidents by Ian Dale, he says, Zachary Taylor was not a political creature. He is one of five presidents who had never held public office before. He was reluctant to be president and knew little of how politics worked. He was no great speaker, did not campaign for votes, and he lasted just 16 months in office, and that's the third shortest spell of all. Taylor was born in 1784 on a plantation in Orange County, Virginia, not far from the birthplace of the fourth president, James Madison, his second cousin. The Taylors were a prominent Virginia family, but when Zachary was only 8 months old, they moved 500 miles west to a spot near a tiny new settlement in Kentucky called Louisville. His father had obtained 400 acres on Beargrass Creek on the Ohio River, part of the generous bonus he'd received for his service as an officer during the War of Independence, and Louisville's rapid expansion helped them prosper. Well, despite that well-to-do background, Zachary had only a rudimentary education, and his early writing is full of spelling mistakes. And at 23, he joined the army and spent the next 40 years as a soldier, but with regular visits back home to oversee the family plantations, which eventually extended to 10,000 acres, worked by hundreds of slaves. This rugged, weather-beaten face in Taylor's portraits came from a life spent mostly outdoors, whether as a soldier or a planter. Like Washington and Andrew Jackson before him, and Grant and Eisenhower subsequently, Taylor reached the presidency through military exploits that brought fame and popularity. So now we come to trying to understand, where did this man stand when it came to spiritual aspects in his life? And we get this from the book, The Presidents and Their Faith, by Grinder and Shaw. And it talks about the fact that Taylor was born into an Episcopalian family and married a devout Episcopalian, Margaret Smith Taylor, but never became a full member of the church himself. Taylor belonged to no church, and we have no record of any profession of faith. The youngest Taylor daughter, Mrs. Elizabeth Bliss, offered the sole family witness about her father's faith. He was a constant reader of the Bible and practiced all its precepts, acknowledging his responsibility to God. As president, and when in Washington, Taylor often worshiped where other chief executives had, at St. John's Church across Lafayette Square from the White House. And we see that at his inauguration in 1849, he delivered a brief address concluding with reference to the high state of prosperity to which the goodness of divine providence has conducted our common country. He says, let us invoke a continuance of the same protecting care which has led us from small beginnings to the eminence we this day occupy. And so perhaps the only other significant or at least interesting statement from Taylor concerning religion is his July 3rd, 1849 proclamation for a day of fasting and humiliation and prayer in response to the deadly cholera epidemic of 1848 and 1849. John Wiley, in his book, The Faith of the Presidents, talks about the fact that he took on something very serious when, in the midst of the inaugural address, he starts to deal with the fact that they were dealing with this bad disease. He finished up his address saying this, in conclusion, I congratulate you, my fellow citizens, on the high state of prosperity to which the goodness of divine providence has conducted our common country. Let us invoke a continuance of the same protecting care which has led us from small beginnings to the eminence we this day occupy. And let us seek to deserve the continuance by prudence and moderation in our counsels. by well-directed attempts to assuage the bitterness which too often marks unavoidable differences of opinion, by the promulgation and practice of just and liberal principles, and by an enlarged patriotism which shall acknowledge no limits but those of our own widespread republic. What makes the timing of this address so interesting is that while his inauguration should have occurred on March 4th, 1849, Taylor refused to do so, waiting until the following day. Now, why did he do that? Because March 4th was a Sunday, and thus Taylor did not want to violate the Lord's Day. And by remaining quiet for that day, Taylor spoke volumes in terms of his religious convictions. Also notable was this. Zachary Taylor declared a time of fasting, humiliation, and prayer to be observed among Americans, and the occasion was in response to this horrible outbreak of cholera. He urged this. He says this, quote, "At a season when the providence of God has manifested itself in the visitation of a fearful pestilence which is spreading itself throughout the land, it is fitting that a people whose reliance has ever been in his protection should humble themselves before his throne, and while acknowledging past transgressions, ask a continuance of the divine mercy. It is therefore earnestly recommended that the first Friday in August be observed throughout the United States as a day of fasting and humiliation and prayer. It is recommended to persons of all religious denominations to abstain as far as practical from secular occupations, and to assemble in their respective places of public worship, to acknowledge the infinite goodness which has watched over our existence as a nation, and so long crowned us with manifold blessings, and to implore the Almighty in his own good time to stop the destroying hand which is now lifted up against us." So we realized as a country that we needed to go to prayer. And so we have this president that's willing to state that. Well, it's a sad story, but we find out that during the night of July 3rd, this is from the book Zachary Taylor by John S.D. Eisenhower, Taylor slept little, quite possibly wrestling in his mind over these dilemmas that were facing him in his presidential duties. The big event of the day was a ceremony in the early afternoon at the site of the future Washington Monument, the laying of its cornerstone. The main speaker at the event was Senator Henry S. Foote, who delivered a long, pious diatribe about sectional understanding. Taylor sat through the 2 hours of rhetoric, but afterward admonished the champion of Southern rights that his conduct should live up to his words. The Washington heat was at its worst. But when the monument ceremony was finished, Taylor went off for a walk. He toured the city in the broiling sun before heading back to the White House. In the course of the day, he ate large quantities of green apples and cherries washed down with ice-cold milk. As a result, he finished the day with symptoms of severe, basically a stomach ache, which did not at first seem serious. Taylor's symptoms, the doctors noted, were very much like those he had suffered the previous September on his trip to Pennsylvania. What the doctors did not know and could not know was that Taylor's malady would soon lead to something worse, infection. Nobody knew the exact nature of the bug or bugs, and they lumped all such maladies under the name of cholera morbus. The fact is that Washington's water and sewage systems were still primitive and unsanitary. Other prominent people, Clayton, Seward, Crawford, and Bliss, were all sick with something like Taylor's condition at the very moment. In no case was anyone sure of the nature of the disease, but by Saturday, July 6th, Taylor was thought to be getting better. He went to his desk, he signed the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty, as well as sending a letter thanking some friend for a gift of a couple of fine salmon. But while the president seemed to be getting better, the infection was spreading. The doctors, who now included four prominent physicians, treated the patient as best they could, and nothing was effective. Still, there was no public alarm at the president's condition. That Saturday, while Taylor was enjoying his brief respite, Congress was meeting to debate some claim and even voted by a close margin to censure Taylor for his role in that scandal. Soon, however, Taylor's condition sank, and by Sunday he dropped a remark predicting his own death. At 1 hour, he would be reported as improving, a cause of celebration, and then bad news would follow. And by 2 p.m. on Tuesday, July 9th, it was obvious that Taylor was sinking and would not recover. The family had been gathered for his last moments, and at 10:35, he died. And his last reported words were, "I'm about to die. I expect the summons soon. I have endeavored to discharge all my original duties faithfully. I regret nothing, but am sorry that I'm about to leave my friends." And so we have these funeral arrangements. They're very elaborate. He's only the second president to die in office. And Taylor was more than a president. He had become an icon. And on Friday, July 12th, the president's body lay in state in the East Room of the White House for public viewing. The next day, Saturday, the formal funeral was held, and at sunrise, guns from the various military installations around Washington began firing salutes, and an estimated 100,000 people thronged the streets to witness that funeral procession. And so we see that this president, who was a fine military leader, became a person that took a stand and did have religious convictions. And finishing up, as we look at this president, we go back to Wiley's book, where he talks about the fact that it seems that Taylor was well aware of the suspicions others had regarding his political opinions and intentions. And it says, "Today, historians do wonder about what he held to religiously. For one, we know that his wife was an incredibly diligent prayer partner. No doubt Peggy had a powerful influence on his faith. And from a few of his public statements, he seems to have tried to live out his life as a good soldier and, for a brief stint, an honorable statesman. At the very least, his life presents a helpful illustration for the Christian life as being akin to the persistence of a good soldier," 2 Timothy 2:3. "But beyond that, he also seemed to recognize God as a sovereign God who judges the thoughts and intents of the heart, even when few words are expressed."